Lord, as always, we're grateful to be able to come to this place and be with these people. Pray, Lord, that your Holy Spirit would come on us now and give us the wisdom to be able to take in truths and discern those things that are not. Make us more like Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen. Well, we've been talking about fear, and today we're going to talk about fear and vulnerability. Fear and vulnerability. Psychologists believe there are probably about 8 basic emotions, and fear is one of them that's on everybody's list. They don't agree always on what those 8 are, but there aren't really that many. Good news for you guys, there are really not that many emotions. So, yeah. You just, if you knew that 8 that you needed to know, you'd be fine. Just figure out those 8. Shocking for some of you guys, it's more than 2. There's actually 8, yeah. And there are nuances and blends and you know, you can go, there's pages. I have, when I do marriage therapy, sometimes, particularly for guys, it's true, I hand them the sheet and I say, talk off this page, and so they can see it right in front of them. There's a whole list of emotions, and happy, sad, glad. But fears, definitely on everybody's list. It's a primary emotion, one of the most powerful emotions, and one that we need to understand and know how to deal with. The Webster definition is, it's a distressing emotion aroused by impending pain, danger, evil, whether real or imagined. Right? So a distressing emotion aroused by impending pain, danger, evil, etc., whether real or imagined. So you can be afraid of something that's real or you can imagine it. But it's a very distressing emotion that's quite powerful. And it signals danger. And psychologically, that's the emotion that we focus in on, is how fear triggers danger. And during therapy, we used to think, when Freud got us all started, that your goal was to overcome your fears. That's what you're supposed to do, is press through them, just to break through the repression barrier and overcome your fears and be a man about it. You know, that's basically what we thought we were supposed to do. We don't believe that anymore. You don't overcome fears, you face them. And it's quite different the way we approach it now. If someone is afraid, they get defensive, right? Defensiveness. When we're defending ourselves from danger. So fear is really the origin of defensiveness. So if I'm defending myself, I'm doing this. I'm pushing against. And if you try to break through someone's defenses, well, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to push back. So then you get this going. You know, we'll break through. You know, get over it. You know, face your, just, you know, stop being so afraid of things. That confrontational method rarely works. It usually makes people worse. So what we found in the early years of therapy is that we were making people get worse by trying to get them to just break through. Instead of breaking through someone's defensiveness, you need to see it from their perspective, and so the wall comes down. Right? This is called danger analysis. The way that we do defense analysis now is danger analysis. So we realize if someone's defensive because they are experiencing fear and danger, then you have to, rather than do this, you do this, so that you can see it from their perspective and they stop fighting. And it requires really putting yourself in the other person's shoes. So now in therapy, we don't say anymore, oh, I'm sorry you felt hurt by what I said. We don't say that. What we say is, I'm sorry I hurt you, is what we say. See the difference? It's because I'm seeing it from their perspective. Now, I don't have to agree with that. You know, I don't know whether I actually hurt the person's feelings, but that's how they see it. That's how they see it. So that's defense analysis now. That's danger analysis. When people are afraid, they're pushing this way, you don't want to push against it. You want to see it from their perspective, so then the wall goes down. I'm sorry I hurt you, and all of a sudden the battle's over. You know, they have no reason to push against you anymore. I'm not afraid of you anymore if you see it how I see it. Now, you can all go out and be therapists now. See, that cost me $60,000. You now know that for free. Yeah, it's actually more complicated than that. But that's the general idea, is that we now see fear as a very important emotion that you want to try to understand. You want to try to understand why you're afraid. Why are you experiencing danger? What is so dangerous to you? Because it's usually not as simple as you think. You think you know. But you may need help in really seeing what it is you're pushing back against. Now, one of the biggest problems we have with fear is it stimulates the fight or flight, but it's actually fight, flight, or freeze syndrome. There's actually three. You thought it was fight or flight, but it's fight, flight, or freeze syndrome. And the mismanagement of the fight, flight, or freeze syndrome leads to lots of problems. But it's a natural response. The fight response is a sympathetic nervous system response. When you get scared, you may have a fight response, which is to get aroused, get anxious, get angry, push back. That's the sympathetic nervous system response. The flight response is a parasympathetic nervous system response, which means you withdraw. So if danger is upon you, you might take that response. You pull away, you flee. But the actual first thing you do is you freeze. Most of us try to decide, should I take flight or should I fight when I'm scared? And the freeze response can also get mismanaged, and you can get stuck. It's very possible to get stuck in the freeze response for years, where you can't decide, should I get in, should I get out, should I fight, should I withdraw? You can get stuck there. That's the mismanagement of the freeze response to fear. Fight, flight, or freeze response. We now know that this is all three of those. The mismanagement of those is our attempt to hide from vulnerability. You don't want to be vulnerable, and so we take one of those strategies to the extreme and mismanage them. Probably the best known marital therapist is a woman by the name of Susan Johnson, who's developed a technique called emotionally focused marital therapy. Maybe some of you have heard of her, but she's quite famous and quite effective. Her technique for helping couples deal with the mismanaged fight, flight, or freeze syndrome is really quite amazing. Because if you've been married, you've been in the fight, flight, or freeze syndrome at least some point in your marriage. Some of us live there. We call that gridlock. That's just where we live. That's what we do, the fight, flight, freeze syndrome. Susan Johnson has narrowed this down, the mismanagement of this syndrome, to the pursuer and distancer dynamic. Pursuer and distancer. That someone typically in the marriage, because of fear and the mismanagement of their fears, critically pursues the other person. They're ironically trying to get something going, trying to get connection, trying to fix the problem. But the way they do it is by criticizing. Not very sexy, but it's very common. That it's typically the woman who is more verbal and more articulate, and she's been irritated for longer because guys kind of cut off from their feelings typically, and they're coasting along. They don't know how they feel, but women do. And so they're yeah. I'm married. And so women are ready to come at it, you know. We need to talk. You know, we call it the harsh startup, where you're really catchy, isn't it, you know? And men can take this role, too. It's just typically women more often take this role. It's the critical pursuit. And if you're critically pursuing, what do you think a less articulate person is going to do? Going to withdraw. Run away. Yeah. So if you're critically pursuing, he's going to run away. All right. Now, to the guys, if you are withdrawing, you got your parasympathetic nervous system thing going, and you're going to pull away. That's your strategy, is to withdraw. What do you think she's going to do? She's going to come after you. That's exactly right. So it's called the pursuer-distancer dynamic, and you each make the other person crazy. That's what you do. The more you withdraw, the more you make her critical, and the more she's critical, the more you withdraw, and that's the dynamic. And again, they can swap roles. I was just yesterday dealing with a couple where he was the critical pursuer, and she was trying to withdraw. Just give me a break. Give me 10 minutes, she'd say. Says, I'm going to chase you around until you talk to me. You know, we're not done. That was really working well for them. That's why I was counseling on Saturday. We had to Skype a session because they were so locked in this. They couldn't get out of it. And what you need to know is all of that is based on the mismanagement of your own fear. That you're mismanaging a natural response. The fight response, the flight response, those are natural responses. But the mismanagement of them is to attempt to avoid your own fears. And people typically get very angry when they get locked into this pattern, because anger is a secondary emotion. Anger is one of the basic emotions, but it's secondary, meaning it's always in response to something else. So if you're angry, you've got something else going on that you need to look at. And fear is one of the primary ones. People get angry when they're scared. Let me tell you about a couple named Drew and Nicole. It's not really their names. He's a successful attorney. She's a very attractive homemaker. She grew up with an alcoholic mother who was abusive, and both verbally and physically. They met when they were teenagers. Drew came from a well-to-do family, but the family was very intact, and appearances were important to them. So they were non-confrontational in that they were passive-aggressive by the way they fought. Everything had to look nice. She came from a crazy family, so if people were angry, they just yelled. They screamed. So he loved her passion and her excitement because his whole family was so buttoned up, they were kind of boring. And she loved his stability. And in the beginning, the things that you fall in love with in the beginning really become irritating later on. His stability then became his emotional unavailability, and her excitement then just became she's flat out crazy. And they would get into fights, typically because she would get her feelings hurt, and then she would come after him quite angrily about that. Big fight they had was over whether or not his family was more important to him than she was. That was a big fight, because he was very attached to his family. They didn't fight, so everything had to look good. Well, she wasn't that interested in looking good. You know, she was into being authentic. And so if she was mad at somebody, she told them that she was mad at them, and his parents wouldn't do that. So it looked like everything was all peachy there. So she would rage at him with a secondary emotion, that emotion of anger, because her primary emotion was the fear that she just wasn't important to him, not really. They've been married for 20 years, and she's still afraid the guy's going to leave her, you know, for I don't know who, just leave her. So she was mismanaging her fear by attacking him. He was mismanaging his fear by withdrawing. And here's the thing. Most of us think that the guy who isn't speaking is not the guy with the problems because he just hides, right? But withdrawal can be just as damaging as somebody screaming at you. You can hurt someone with what you do not say just as much as with what you do say. And he wasn't aware of this. He thought she had all the power. She was the one. I mean, he's like, look what I have to live with, you know, because she would be yelling and cursing and stuff. And yet his withdrawal would damage her in such a way that it would, like, pour gasoline on a fire. So withdrawal can be just as powerful, just as damaging, just as hurtful, put it that way, just as hurtful as someone who has the critical pursuit. And we only began to resolve this when we could get out of that the mismanagement of the fight-flight syndrome and talk about the fear underneath it. Her fear that she really wasn't valuable to him and his fear that she really didn't respect him, because when she uncorked. I mean, say demeaning things, belittling things, attacking things. And she would say, trying to get to you. She'd say, I'm trying to reach you. I'm trying to get to you. Do you have any feelings about anything? And the more she would attack him, the more he would wall off. When they stopped the secondary emotion of anger and talked about the primary emotion of fear, what she was really afraid of, what he was really afraid of, when she saw that he was afraid, that she had no respect for him, that she had cried because she had so much respect for him. The guy had provided a great family for her and for their kids. She was just trying to get some connection with him. And she asked him for forgiveness. For the first time in 20 years, she said, I had no idea that I was making you feel that way. I just wanted to know how you felt about things and thought that I wasn't important. And they repaired years of damage by getting to the fear, by talking about what they were afraid of, the primary emotion. We reverse the mismanagement of the fight-flight syndrome when we risk vulnerability to face our fears. We face the fears. Don't overcome them. Don't break through them. We face them. And in naming them, it's amazing the power that has to remove the dysfunction in that syndrome. Job 3:25. What I have feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. You become what you fear. You've heard people say that, right? You become what you fear. It's actually true if what you're trying to do is avoid your fears. The human mind is very complex. It's not the prefrontal cortex is not like any other animal. I know we make a lot of comparative studies with other animals, but our capacity to think and reason and be aware and self-conscious is unlike any other animal, which is great. That means you have this great thinking capacity, but it also works against you a lot of the time too. You're making up things and seeing things that aren't there and coming to conclusions, like we were talking about last week. You're actually hardwired to think you know the intentions of other people. You have these mirror neurons in your brain that are seeking relationship with other people, and you automatically think you know what the other person is going to do. you complete the cycle. If they, someone starts to bring up their hand in your brain, you see them drinking, you see them completing the action. So you have to be aware of that, that you think you already know what people's intentions are. Unfortunately, you're not always right. It's just that you think you know. We get into trouble when we not only try to break through our fears, as I was talking about, but when we try to avoid them. It creates the illusion of safety. It is actually not possible to avoid your fears. If you shove them back into some recess of your mind because you think that you can just compartmentalize it and put it away, it doesn't work that way. It comes out later. If you're trying to avoid your fears, things happen. Like a moth to a flame, you are drawn to the thing you fear if you're trying to avoid it. Let me give you an example of what I mean. A woman I'll call Jessica. You know, I love living in Los Angeles because we have a steady stream of babysitters who come from all over the world to be actresses here in L.A. You know, they want to do nanny work because it's flexible, so they can go on their auditions. And so we've had wonderful nannies coming, and they come from small towns in the Midwest. They come to Hollywood to make their fame and fortune. And we get them with good work ethic because we like people who are raised on a farm. That's what we prefer. Master's degree, but grew up on a farm. That's what we. And you can find lots of them here in LA. They have this good work ethic. You know, if they see a mess, they clean it up. You know, it's not like my kids. And they on the farm, you had to do that. Anybody grew up on a farm? You know what I'm talking about, right? The work ethic, isn't it? Yeah. So Jessica was one of those. She came from a small town in the Midwest, hard worker. She came from a good family, but she didn't really fit into the traditional mold. She wasn't really happy with rural life, and from a small age, she wanted to be an actress. She knew she wanted to be an actress, so she came to L.A. to do exactly that. Parents, of course, not supportive of that. They thought, L.A. is like Sodom and Gomorrah to them. Anything on the West Coast or East Coast is just bad, is what they believed. So she got involved in school plays. Her parents, thinking they were being good parents, were supportive of her academics, but they rarely went to the plays because they really didn't want to encourage this thing. But it had her. How she felt on stage was unlike any other place, so she had to come, and she did. And she got an agent right away. She got in a movie, was doing some commercials, and was finally living her dream. She was successful, at least in her own eyes, even if she couldn't, especially in her father's eyes, be successful. She had this, well, he told her he wasn't really happy with her pursuing this career. And she thought that if she were just successful enough, she'd show him. Then, eventually, he'd see that she really was something. Well, unfortunately, Hollywood is fickle. As one person once told me, once you get your paycheck, you're unemployed. That's how it works in Hollywood. As soon as you get paid, you're out of a job. Gradually, she stopped booking jobs. The auditions tapered off. Her agent eventually let her go. She was considered talented, but no longer successful. She was no longer the kid with great potential. Now she was the woman who had to face her fears. She had left her hometown for two reasons. One, to pursue something that she loved, which was acting. But two, to flee her fear of failure, especially in her father's eyes. She was running towards something and she was running away from something, both at the same time, trying to run away from the fear that she was a disappointment to her, in her father's eyes. Now, on some level, you'd say she had an issue with her father, and it's true, but she, at a deeper level, had an issue with herself. She wasn't just pursuing a dream, she was escaping a fear. We become what we fear when we try to avoid it. Underneath, she had unfinished business with herself. She feared that her father might be right. Maybe she wasn't enough. And that's the key phrase. Maybe she wasn't enough. She grew up thinking, I was never enough for him. You know, he didn't come to my plays. You know, I wasn't really athletic. I wasn't really interested in the things he wanted me to be interested in. And for a kid, it goes from maybe I'm not good enough at those things to maybe I'm not enough. That's where it goes to. And so then she had that underlying fear that maybe she wasn't enough. And that caused her to cling to her dream of becoming famous long past the time when it was possible to do it. She was clinging to it out of fear, not out of love. She was trying to avoid failure more than achieve success, because she just didn't want to be a failure in her father's eyes, right? And when you're trying to avoid something, when are you done? When are you done ever trying to avoid? If you're trying to pursue something, you finally get there, right? But if you're trying to avoid something, you're never done. You're never done trying to avoid a fear. So she did become not enough, and not enough in her own profession. And when you're trying to avoid failure or fear of it, you need to find someone else to blame. So how do you know if you're trying to avoid your fear of failure? You're blaming somebody. I never want to be anything like my parents. Maybe that's what you say. Or maybe you say, the only reason I drink so much is because of you. Maybe you say that. Or maybe you say, the only person I'm unhappy around is you. I get along with everybody else except for you. You're the only person I can't get around with. I have lots of friends except for you. You know? You ever heard that or said that? That's blame. And blame is the tool we use to avoid our own fears. Blame is an attempt to avoid your fear and your pain. So you're looking to externalize it to someone else. And that is the mismanagement of the freeze response. If you're blaming someone, you're trying to evaluate, should I fight or flight, right? But if you're blaming someone, it's the dysfunctional evaluation of the situation. You're trying to lodge the blame out here when really your issue is here. Most of our issues in life have to do with ourselves rather than other people. You just want to believe it's the other people. But the biggest issues you have in life have to do with yourself. This complicated mind, 90% of it is outside of your conscious awareness. You're using about 10% of your mind. Some of you, the really bright ones in the room, 12, maybe 13. But most of your mind is operating outside your awareness, like right over here, right? And so this huge complex machinery that you've got going on is trying to figure out, what is my crisis in front of me, right? And usually the crisis has to do with yourself, but you're just not able to see it. You're doubting whether or not you're enough, even though you're sure it's your father's fault for not accepting you. You know, if he would only have accepted me, you know. Well, at some point you've internalized that, and now your battle is with your own feelings about yourself. If you stay only above the surface of the water, looking at the superficial things, that yes, her father should have come to her place, that's true, but that's only superficial. The real issue is what it means to you now about you. Job 3:25. What I feared has come upon me. What I dreaded has happened to me. If you fear you're not enough and you don't face that fear of being enough, then it becomes true in your life. You find yourself wrestling with things and thinking that something outside of you. So how is it that we face our fears? We stop blaming. I would stop blaming other people. If you find yourself really still blaming someone else for your circumstances in your life, remember, as we say in psychology, the thing is not the thing. The thing is not the thing. If you're really, really upset with someone for the thing they did to you, it's got psychological meaning for you. You need to look at what the meaning is to you of the thing. You know, my father never went to my plays. Okay, that's true, but that's not the real thing. The real thing might be that you have some fear that you're not enough. So we become what we fear when we try to avoid those fears. And this gets me to vulnerability. Really facing our fears has to do with the capacity to be vulnerable. So what is vulnerability? Well, it's where we all start in life. We're physically and emotionally completely vulnerable, more so than any other animal. We're completely dependent when we're born into life. Other animals, when they get born, they stand up and run around, you know. We don't. It takes months before you can survive on your own. We are incredibly dependent creatures. And it's through our connection to other people that we grow. Now the infant researchers are doing amazing things now. They're looking at little tiny babies, just weeks old. And they're discovering these mirror neurons that I was talking about, that you're hardwired, little six-week-old babies. When they see videos of smiling faces, the area of the brain that controls the smiling muscles in their brain lights up. Right? Or they see a frowning face, those neurons that control the frowning muscles in their face light up. So you can't help it, you know. From birth, if I see somebody smile, I want to smile. If I see somebody frown, I get sad. You drink a cup of coffee, I got to have one. You know, it's just, that's a different deal, but but it's just the way, that's just the way we're hardwired. We're brought into life hardwired to respond and dependent upon our relationships with other people. The great pediatrician Donald Winnicott said there's no such thing as a baby. Maybe you've heard that phrase before, no such thing as a baby. It means that the mother and baby are so interconnected with each other that you can't talk about an individual baby without talking about the relationship with the mother. The mother smiles, the baby smiles. The mother cries, the baby cries. If you have an anxious mother in during her pregnancy, the babies come out anxious. The connection there is profound. We are incredibly vulnerable creatures and dependent on each other. That's just the way we come into life. Vulnerability is the environment in which our true self comes out. Our understanding of personality has changed. Freud got us started in the right direction, but he was wrong about a lot of stuff. We used to think that separation and individuation was health. And the infant researchers told us that, Margaret Mahler's research. You need to grow up and separate and individuate, be your own person. Nobody believes that anymore. Sorry, all you people who were in therapy 30 years ago. We got better, so come back. We now understand that having a healthy relationship with other people is the way your life should be the rest of your life. You don't grow up and separate. You grow up and become your own person, always connected to other people. You absolutely need connection to other people your whole life. The goal is not to grow up and be an individual. Individuality is a relational construct that we were talking about last week. That what you want to do is have your own distinctiveness about you, but always connected to others around you. That's where my true self comes out, is through healthy connections with other people. Up until the 70s, we thought narcissistic personality disorders were untreatable. I don't have to tell you what a narcissistic personality disorder is. You know them. They're unmistakable, you know, the grandiosity, you know, the focus on oneself. They were untreatable because they couldn't be vulnerable. So in therapy, we just thought, well, we can help this and this and this, but we can't help this. This is one of the categories we can't help, because we didn't know that being vulnerable in therapy itself was a critical part of the process. And now we're able to help people be vulnerable. And a guy by the name of Heinz Kohut developed a whole science of psychology based on the narcissistic personality disorder. He thought, these guys are tough. Let's figure out how we can help these guys. They're running the world. You might as well help them in therapy. So we focused on it, and we came up with a treatment to help people be vulnerable. And helping them be vulnerable, we now have a way to treat anything. We treat anything and everything. In therapy, because we now have an understanding of personality that, no, we don't want people to grow up and be separate and alone and lone rangers. We want them to figure out how to love well and connect well and relate well their entire life. Let me tell you what vulnerability is not. Vulnerability is not openness. There are two different things. We touched on this just briefly last week. The definition of open is not closed or barred at the time, set so as to permit passage through, having no means of closing or barring. Open people are people who will tell you stuff about themselves. They'll give you information, they'll over-disclose. When you're with them, they give the appearance of being at least confident. But vulnerability is this: capable or susceptible to being wounded or hurt as by a weapon, open to attack, criticism, temptation. Vulnerable is when not I'm just telling you things about myself, but I'm placing my heart in a position where I could get hurt. I'm taking the next step. Vulnerability is when I'm risking with you my failures, risking with you when it matters to me. Your opinion does matter to me. So vulnerability requires not just being open about the facts, like people who, well, they'll fight in marriage counseling often this way. Well, it's true, isn't it? You know, they just beat each other up with the facts. That's not vulnerability. Maybe open to share the facts, but vulnerability is when you risk, when you open up and say, okay, let me tell you something about me that could hurt, that could get me hurt. So vulnerability is taking a risk with significant others. Not just sharing the facts, but it's giving your heart in a courageous act of love. Vulnerability is not powerlessness. Now, you can be victimized. If you're victimized by circumstances, that means you have been overpowered by circumstances. But to be a victim is to believe you're powerless. Those are two different things. And we have now research. There is a difference between people who were traumatized and believe they're a victim because they were traumatized. Like, you might be in a car wreck, and so for years afterwards, you can't go through that intersection, you know, because you're traumatized by it. And you almost feel powerless over those feelings. That's different than people who grew up learning that they're powerless, a belief about yourself. If the belief about yourself is that you're powerless, that is a victim mindset, not just a victim of circumstances. And just like the narcissistic personality disorder, victims have what we call negative grandiosity. Their problems are too big. You know, you can't help. You know, if you really knew how much I'm suffering, man, you must not have any idea how much I'm suffering. That negative grandiosity is what we call a victim mindset. You know, I'm powerless against my circumstances. So if you knew my childhood, you would not be saying that to me. You know, when you're trying to get them to, you know, get dressed and come to church, you know, you should need to be around people, and you just have no idea how much I'm suffering. That victim mindset is powerlessness, and vulnerability is not that. That's not being vulnerable.
That's the victim's trap?
The victim trap, that's right. Right, I wrote a whole book on that. People who get locked into that mindset, and they're looking for people to play a messianic role with them, you know. So if I'm powerless, I need to find someone who's going to buy into that with me, that I'm powerless, and then we get locked into this dance that doesn't go anywhere because they don't want to change. They just want to interact with someone who will also believe they're powerless. And, you know, a lot of well-meaning people get caught up in those relationships thinking, you know, I've tried for years to help this person, and they just don't ever seem to be getting better. Well, it's because they're getting what they want. We're locked in this dynamic.
Codependence comes from that.
Yeah. Codependence is another sort of phrase we've used for that dance that people get locked into. Vulnerability is not weakness. We were talking about last week, the greatest fear of men in our society today is that we are fear being perceived as weak. And so we often confuse vulnerability with weakness, that if I'm vulnerable, it means I'm weak. Well, it does mean that you're placing yourself in a situation where you could get hurt. But getting hurt doesn't mean you're weak. Those are two different things. My willingness to get hurt actually comes from a position of strength, that I'm telling you I think I can handle it. You can hurt me. That doesn't mean I'm weak. That means I'm hurt. Those are two different things. That actually, for men, most of their weaknesses, addictions, affairs, arrogance, dishonesty, comes from a fear of vulnerability, not from being vulnerable, which means they're weak. And so for us as men, we've got this dilemma. We have this fear of being weak, but we know women want us to pretend to be vulnerable. So we're locked in this, you know, approach avoidance thing, you know. We read, so we know what you want us to do, but we've fear that vulnerability is weakness, so it's a very tough thing for us. It's not easy at all. How many people know Joseph Brewer? He was a neurologist about 100 years ago. Joseph Brewer, you kind of, sort of vaguely sounds familiar, doesn't it? But most people don't know his name. Joseph Brewer was a medical doctor, and he had patients coming, this is about 100, more than 100 years ago now, 100 and almost 40 years ago. Patients would come into his office reporting symptoms. He was a neurologist, so one of the symptoms that his patients report is glove hysteria. Glove hysteria is where the hand is numb as if you're wearing a glove. So it's numb like this, and the women couldn't move their hands at all. Now, he was a neurologist, so he knew that's not possible. You've got to be numb here or numb here, but you can't be numb here. So that's not possible. So he started to try to get the symptoms and talk with them about what was going on. And he found out, this was, again, about 140 years ago, that these women were having sexual fantasies about what to do with this hand, or maybe what they had done with this hand. And 140 years ago, there weren't a lot of options that were talked about. So they had all this stuff that was locked up inside, and so the brain, this wonderful thing that you have called the brain, comes to the rescue and numbs the hand. So problem solved, right? And what he found is that by getting them to be vulnerable, getting them to risk the shame and humiliation of saying what their fantasies were, and him connecting the dots, they got the feeling back in their hand, developed the talking cure. And Brewer, all this vulnerability was so intense for him that he was not comfortable with this kind of vulnerability. This is 140 years ago. So he handed this project over to his young associate, a man by the name of Sigmund Freud, who loved it. He was like a voyeur. He was seeing 10 people a day. Tell me more, you know. He saw so many people that he had to sit behind them. He had them lay on a couch so he could sit over here and just take notes, you know, all the vulnerability that was coming out of them, you know. But the point is that those of us who are interested in and can tolerate and welcome vulnerability welcome the true self out of other people. And if you're afraid of it, if it's too much for you, you're cutting yourself off from the greatest power in human relationship, the power to elicit true selves from other people. That if Joseph Brewer had just been more comfortable with vulnerability, I'd be talking about him today, not Sigmund Freud. But he handed it all over to him because he was uncomfortable with vulnerability. So think about that in your own life. You know, who are you, Sigmund Freud or Joseph Brewer? You know, are you kind of saying, oh, that's too much for me, you know? Or are you Freud, who's kind of a voyeur and wants to hear more and really, really wanted to get into the deepest places in people's psyche? We now know that the capacity to be vulnerable is a power. It's the power for true self and the expression of true self in relationships with other people. And here's the thing about vulnerability. If I were to show you Casablanca, and remember the story at the end where Humphrey Bogart, tells Ilsa that, no, the troubles of two people don't amount to a hill of beans. You need to go off you go and do great things with the man you love. And that vulnerable kind of coming of age, all of us would admire him for that, right? Instead of being selfish and the immature alcoholic that he was the whole movie, he grew up, you know, and he became a vulnerable man who could love something bigger than himself. Remember that scene, you know, as they're walking off there on the tarmac? His vulnerability is something we're all drawn to. And if anyone else in the room was willing to be that vulnerable, you'd be drawn to them and you'd say, I respect that, I admire that. And then if I said, okay, now you stand up and be vulnerable, nobody would want to do it. We admire it and we love it when we see it in other people, but everybody fears it, doing it themselves. Isn't that funny? We're all hypocrites. You really are attracted to it when other people are vulnerable, and you fear it when it's your turn to be vulnerable. We're all afraid of getting hurt. Because to be vulnerable, you have to risk getting hurt. That's how the only way you can be vulnerable. And we're now finding the most powerful avenue to authenticity that we have, is to elicit it and to be it, to be vulnerable. So why do we fear it? If it's all that powerful, why do we fear it, right? Well, we fear it because it exposes our dependence upon other people. Yes, you haven't outgrown your infancy. We are all radically dependent upon each other. The psychoanalyst and philosopher Robert Stalerow calls it the unbearable embeddedness of being. That's the way he puts it. I know. That being itself is embedded in dependent relationships, and it's unbearable. Because I have to trust you. In order for me to be my authentic self, I've got to be vulnerable with you, and I don't trust you. Because you're not going to say the right thing. I'm going to get hurt. So my fear of my fundamental dependent nature causes me to fear vulnerability. The very thing I need to be my true self, I fear it because it makes me realize how dependent I am upon you to be me. We fear it, of course, because we fear exploitation by other people. We fear being abused by someone more powerful or co-opted by someone who's needy or neglected by someone who means well but is unavailable. So we fear getting exploited. And that's probably one of the most common dynamics we see in therapy is people who are abused in childhood come to believe that vulnerability leads to exploitation. They just come to believe that. Because if you trust your parents to protect you and they hurt you, the very people who you're supposed to trust hurt you, then you have this belief, if I'm vulnerable, I'm going to get exploited. So even though they come to therapy and say, I want you to help me, I'm going to, oh, great, well, so be vulnerable with me and I'll help you. Well, their brain says, oh, no, no. So all of this defensive strategies come out and the maneuvering and the denial and the repression because they believe actually be vulnerable means I'm going to get exploited. And it's so dug in that it takes years and years to get that those wires uncrossed. But for most of us, really, vulnerability exposes us to our own feelings. What is the real danger? What is the real danger? The real danger is you're going to feel something. That's the real danger. You're going to feel hurt. You're going to feel scared. You're going to feel humiliated. You're going to feel something, some intense emotion. For pretty much most of us today, the danger isn't physical. The bear's not going to jump out of the woods and get you. That's not going to happen anymore. But what is going to happen is you're going to feel something. And so we have to develop the ability to deal with our own feelings and not fear our own feelings, not fear our own emotions, to be vulnerable. Let me tell you about Katie. Katie came to therapy because she was having massive panic attacks. Now, some of you have had panic attacks. Most of you have not. I'm not talking about anxiety. I'm talking about a panic attack. A panic attack is when your body simulates a heart attack. And people go to the hospital all the time with these. It's terrifying, and it's exactly like you're having a heart attack, where your heart is pounding out of your chest, your hands get clammy, you might faint, you definitely feel faint, you can't breathe, you feel like something's terribly wrong, you feel this restriction in your chest, it's exactly like a heart attack, and you can't tell the difference. And so people often are rushed to the hospital with a panic attack because their body is simulating a heart attack. Now, you cannot die from a panic attack. It isn't a heart attack. It eventually will go away, but your body then can create some neurons getting crossed, and then you get you're predisposed to keep having them. And so some people have lots of them, and Katie was one of them. She was raised in an alcoholic home. I'm beating up on the alcoholics today here. Abusive father who was quite scary. He actually would chase her and her mother around when he got drunk. Some alcoholics are angry, and he was one of those. So she learned not to show her fear. Her mother would tell her to just ignore it, you know, don't, because you'll make it worse, you know, if you cry or get upset. So she would tell her to ignore it. So then she learned to ignore all of her feelings. And that's what creates a panic attack, is when you're trying to not feel your feelings. See, it starts with anxiety. We all have what we call signal anxiety, which means it's signaling that something's going on. Signal anxiety is a good thing. You want to have signal anxiety. It makes you pay attention, like when you step in the street and you see a car. Signal anxiety, you know, alerts you, pay attention. Well, what happens with panic attacks is people who have signal anxiety, it's normal, fear it. They then fear their own anxiety, so they try to not feel the anxiety. So, that's going to lead to something bad. Oh, my gosh, something really bad's going to happen. But for her, for Katie, really bad was like my dad beating my mom or something really bad. So she would try to not have her anxiety. Well, now you've got your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system fighting. If you're trying to screw down your feelings and not feel them, your body overloads. So trying to not have your anxiety or fearing it and fighting it is what creates panic attacks, in a nutshell. So in trying to stuff it down, she made it worse. So she got better, and she did get better, is we were able to separate out fear from anxiety. You should be anxious. Things should make you anxious. If you don't have anxiety, you're dead. So anxiety is a good thing. But fearing it is a problem. So she then learned, oh, wait, that's not just anxiety. Now I'm afraid. She would be able to distinguish her fears and articulate her fears. Yes, I'm afraid something's going to happen. And the more we could clarify and separate fear from anxiety, the more she could let her anxiety just roll over her. You know, she could be on the freeway and think, ooh, boy, I don't know if this is a good place to be. Freeways make me anxious. Oh, yeah, that's normal. I don't have to fear the anxiety anymore. But fearing our own feelings makes them worse. And in this case, it's just a dramatic example of that. She now has a tolerance to be vulnerable with lots of feelings and be able to articulate lots of different kinds of feelings, and she doesn't have panic attacks anymore. She gets anxious, but she doesn't have the attacks that for her seemed life-threatening. So, but what is the real tragic response of fearing to be vulnerable to our own feelings? Self-preservation at all cost. Self-preservation at all cost. I know a man who's a theologian. He's the editor of a magazine called Evangelica. And I asked him once what his definition of sin was. He said it's self-preservation at all cost. That's what sin is. He said, the problem is not with your behavior. Sin is not the problem with your behavior, but that you refuse to take Jesus as your friend, and you just try to do it by yourself. That was his summing up of sin all in one phrase. Self-preservation at all costs. You're just going to do it your way, and you're going to leave Jesus and God out of it. There's sin. Matthew 11:19. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of the tax gatherers and sinners. Yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds. So this is what they said about our God. Let me read that again. He came eating and drinking, and they said, behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax gatherers and sinners. That was his reputation in the community. He was a man who was vulnerable enough to walk among us. He decided to come and be human. He went to parties, and he drank, apparently. And he hung out with people, some of which had sketchy backgrounds. But he was a real man who was willing to be vulnerable, and his vulnerability is our salvation. He was willing to be that for us, and that is what we believe is our salvation is based upon, that God was vulnerable to us. Fyodor Dostoevsky wrote a book about a man named Prince Myshkin. Some of you have read this book. Myshkin is an extremely vulnerable figure. He's completely open, completely vulnerable, and he goes out through the whole book just being of service to everybody in the book. And he's a Christ-like figure that by the end of the book, everyone finds him to be a healing figure in their lives just because of his vulnerability. He was completely vulnerable to everyone. People were taking advantage of him, and people were misusing his vulnerability, but his vulnerability was so powerful that they ended up having to look at themselves, and they get transformed by this guy's vulnerability. And you know what Dostoevsky titled the book? Remember, anybody remember the name of the book? The Idiot. That's right. Alice knows. The Idiot. Right? That kind of powerful vulnerability that's transforming, most of us think you'd have to be an idiot to be that vulnerable. You'd have to be an idiot to be God and come and be a man that people are going to make fun of and call you a drunkard and gluttonous, right, because you go to parties. But it's through that vulnerability that lives are transformed. It's a power that you have to be that way with other people that transforms lives. It's your vulnerability that's powerful. You don't want to do it, and you'll think you'll be an idiot for doing it, but there's few things you can do that's more powerful in the lives of other people than have that transforming kind of vulnerability that risks. I asked my psychological mentor, Robert Stahlerow, a man that I've studied with for many, many years, what his definition of psychopathology was. So I want to know what would you summarize it down to in one sentence? You know what he said? Self-preservation at all costs. Self-preservation at all costs. The refusal to be vulnerable. So, wait a minute. The definition of sin is self-preservation at all costs. The definition of psychopathology is self-preservation at all costs. Wait a minute. They're the same thing? Yeah, it is. It's our refusal to be vulnerable. It's our decision to do it our own way. Think about it. Even psychosis is a retreat into your own world. I'm not going to be vulnerable with you. I'm going to make up my own craziness. Right? Live my own crazy world. It's a refusal to be vulnerable at its extreme. There are chemical reasons for psychosis. You didn't say that, but the result of it is that. The inability to actually be vulnerable in the way that we're talking about it here. We thwart new relationships trying not to allow the traumas of the past being repeated in our lives. Our walls of defenses become our prison of isolation. Self-preservation at all costs. That I think is the tragic result of fear of vulnerability. Let me tell you about Tom and Tina. Married for 11 years, got 2 kids, marital counseling. They get caught in this destructive pattern that everybody gets caught in. And so in one session, Tina cries out for affirmation over some weight loss. She'd been working on losing weight, and she'd lost 13 pounds, even though it was through the holidays and their vacation and parties and stuff. She lost 13 pounds over the holidays. I mean, that's impressive. She was serious about it. And she was trying to get Tom to say that he was proud of her. He finally does. Sometimes I have to hold him down and make him say it, say these words, and he says the words. And it's funny, even though it's scripted, it's still powerful. And when he says it to her, she, she bursts into tears and says, well, that's all I needed. He says, I am proud of you. You know, I'm proud of you for that. You showed determination. And, you know, you stuck with it. I'm proud of you. Bursts into tears. She says, that's all I needed. Then within about 2 seconds, she says, why haven't you ever said that before? Entrenched in the pattern. And that moment of vulnerability where she was really getting what she wanted, it felt vulnerable for her. And so it scared her. Vulnerability scares us. So then she retreats to the familiar pattern of being disappointed in him. Well, you've never said that before. You're just saying because he made you say it. You know, and then she retreats into that pattern. And I try to point out to her that if she criticizes Tom when he's vulnerable, he's not likely to do it again. You know, you know, just the basic, you know, cause and effect here, you know. You have to, positive reinforcement, you know. And then she turns at me and says, don't tell me I'm not supposed to be angry. I'm just expressing my feelings. Yeah, I know. That's my son last week. No. You can use your feelings as a way to avoid vulnerability, too. You can use them as a weapon to bludgeon. She was not being vulnerable. She was expressing her anger, but anger is secondary, remember? To be vulnerable, you have to get underneath that. You have to talk about the fear. You have to talk about the hurt, the disappointment, the longings that you have. That's vulnerable. Being angry is not vulnerable. You know, that's secondary. That's the pathway to being vulnerable. But don't stop there. Don't stop there. When fear is dominant, then behavior is defensive. We find that our most inauthentic behavior comes out of our fear of vulnerability. George Prentice said, when a young man complains that a young lady has no heart, it's a pretty good sign that she probably has his. That we find ourselves defensive when we're afraid. And we want to point out the problems in everyone else. And probably the worst consequence of the fear of vulnerability is meanness. That actually good people can end up being mean because they're afraid to be vulnerable. That our fear can push us into being defensive, into denial, and even meanness towards other people. There are bad people who would be less dangerous if they had no good in them. It's an old quote. There are, yes, good people that can be dangerous because when they are afraid to be vulnerable, they can be mean. So what's our cure? What's the cure for the fear of vulnerability? Well, it's two things, courage and connection. Of course, courage is going to be the antidote to fear, right? Courage. But remember, courage is not the absence of fear, it's faith and action in the presence of fear. If you're not afraid, it's not courage. It's only courage if you are afraid and you're willing to take action while you're afraid. That's what courage is. Courage is saying yes to life when you're afraid. That's what courage is. I'm saying yes. I'm not going to say no. I'm going to figure out what saying yes means in this situation, this scenario. I'm not sure yet, but I'm not going to say no. I'm going to say yes. And I'm scared to death, but I'm going to say yes. You don't know the outcome. Like Kierkegaard said, you know, life can only be understood looking backwards, but you have to live it looking forwards. That's just how it is. You've got to courageously move ahead, not knowing what the outcome is going to be. But I'm going to courageously say yes, even though I'm afraid. And how do you know if you have courage in your life? You'll have joy. Joy is the expression of courage. If you're lacking joy in your life, perhaps the problem is that you're lacking courage. If there's an absence of joy in your life, then think about this. Are you saying yes even though you're afraid? Are you? What else is the sign of courage? Gratitude. People who are letting go of the scarcity mentality. Gratitude means I'm going to let go of scarcity. I'm going to believe that there is enough. And if you believe that there is enough, you'll eventually believe that you are enough. That's how gratitude works. Compassion. You'll have compassion. You'll have compassion for yourself. Compassion for yourself means letting go of perfectionism. Courage means letting go of perfectionism for yourself. And compassion for other people means letting go of control. You'll be able to let go of control when you have compassion for others. And you'll be pursuing meaning in life rather than just trying to follow the shoulds. Those are the markers of a courageous life. Well, connection then grows out of that. You'll be connected to other people if you live that courageous life in the face of your own fears. And anything, as I was telling you last week, anything is possible if you don't have to do it alone. That we're hardwired to be relational people, to be connected to other people, and our courageous ability to be vulnerable is what connects us to other people. And that's where you grow. That's where power and growth happens, in those connections. It's vulnerable to our significant others. I don't think you should be vulnerable with everyone. As Dostoevsky says, that would be an idiot. But you need to be vulnerable to someone. You need to know who your significant others are that you can be vulnerable to. And vulnerability has boundaries to it, too. I mean, that it's part of what it means to be vulnerable, is to know what your correct boundaries are. The mature person has both fear and vulnerability in his or her life. The definition of psychological health is the capacity to be vulnerable to significant others. It's the opposite of psychopathology. And the definition of righteousness is the capacity to be vulnerable with God. That's the opposite of sin. I think those are our goals, is developing the capacity to be vulnerable, both in our horizontal relationships and in our vertical ones. And then we will live, as Kierkegaard says, in fear and trembling. One of his most famous books was fear. The guy wrote books that were, the titles are terrible. But Fear and Trembling was that we all are on the road to Mount Moriah, you know, where Abraham was taking Isaac to be slain. That's all of us. We all are living a life where we don't know what the outcome is. We believe God's going to save us and do the right thing, but we're going to move forward and keep moving ahead with our fear and with our anxieties. But you keep saying yes, and you keep moving forward in life. You can't escape the anxiety of life, but you can decide to move forward or not. He wrote a book after that he called Sickness Unto Death, another real page-turner. Sickness unto death was, okay, so yes, we're all on the road to Mount Moriah. We all live with fear and trembling, and you either choose to go forward believing God's going to somehow deliver you from the dire outcome. But if you do that in despair, then you have the sickness unto death. The point is not to go despairing. You go with courage. You say, yes, life is scary. Yes, life is hard. And I don't know the outcome, but I'm going to say yes to life. That is a life well lived. Not going, realizing that it's scary and anxiety-provoking, and you're despairing the whole way. He calls that the sickness unto death. And that is not how we'll live. We're going to live well, being healthy and vulnerable, created in the image of God. Well, those are my thoughts. I know I've got to stop. I went 5 minutes over. Shall we take time for a question, or will, you can leave if you need to leave. We'll take, yes.
Given all of this.
Yes. Yep.
You have to be careful how many drinks you have before you go to a fraternity party.
How many drinks you have?
You have to be careful about your dialogue before sex.
Uh-huh.
You have to be careful about whether your grandson is going to join a football team in New Jersey. You have to be, you know, that's a different world. But I'm wondering how the mind works. If one is surely a bit risk averse outside your sphere, mm-hmm. does the mind distinguish? And should the mind, and can the mind distinguish between that risk aversion outside your sphere and you just compartmentalize? I'm concerned about the specialization issue here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's an answer to it, but at a time when there are so many reasons to fear, when you go to a hospital, when you do all these things, and mm-hmm. you have to go through all this stuff, does that have an effect on your resistance to risk in general? I suppose that it's a poor question and it has nothing to do with it, but it just sounds a little bit strange at a time when everybody's told to be on guard,
mm-hmm.
when there's so much surveillance, you don't even know what you can talk about in the cell phone, and then all of a sudden, this is such a nice cozy cocoon here, mm-hmm. and take advantage of it. I don't think there's an answer to it, but I'm just kind of struck by the dichotomy here.
The answer is yes. If you live your life very much consumed, if you're watching the news every night, and you live your life consumed with the very real dangers of our world, you're probably going to get pretty scared. And that will absolutely affect your intimate relationships. You will absolutely find it harder to be vulnerable in the context where you should be vulnerable and can be vulnerable. Yes, I love the internet and I love CNN, but it's really just scaring the heck out of all of us because we've got it in our living rooms now. And yeah, I think it is affecting our capacity to be vulnerable in our other relationships.
Have you ever had a chance to notice if there is a correlation between a prayer life, an active prayer life, and dealing with
fear? I'm sure there is research. I'm sure there is. They're researching all aspects of religion now. But I know they have studied, there's a famous study called the Nun Study, where they studied their nuns and their behaviors, and they had all kinds of amazing results. I mean, after the nuns died, they found out that a huge percentage of them had Alzheimer's, but nobody knew it, you know, because their prayer life and their community life was so rich that it somehow compensated for the brain's deteriorating. You know, they did postmortems, you know, afterwards. So yeah, they've done a lot of research on the psychological benefits of Christian disciplines. Yes.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
It's all right.
Are you finished?
Sure. Yeah.
you said that joy was a sign of
courage.
Yeah,
if you're living a courageous life.
And the next thing is what? Joy and...
Gratitude.
Mm-hmm. Can you have one of those and not the other?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Okay. You can have one and not the other. So they're just markers. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean, but they're markers. If you have those things. I think if you're not joyful, I think you need to ask the question, am I courageously saying yes in the face of my fears? I mean, that's a good question to ask. Yes?
Is it fear is self-preservation against all gods?
Yes.
We are trusting ourselves. We are not trusting God.
Right.
So when we trust God, the only fear that we should have is the fear of God, which is the beginning of all wisdom.
Yeah, except that I think Psalms means something else when it says the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Yeah, the word actually means respect, means learning your limitations. Fear of God means I know I'm not God, which is good.
Yeah, that's good.
Yes.
So I'm trying to follow your logic.
Me too.
Expression.
Yeah. I get lost.
So somebody who was hurt in the past and you've got the wall up and you're, you know, not vulnerable.
Yeah.
When you start getting vulnerable with each, you try to use discernment, which at this point you're not quite sure what it is.
Right.
You've not experienced it. So as you do it, you get hurt.
Yes.
It brings up the past.
Yes.
So then you try to connect dots if you're able to see a therapist, whatever. Then you meet somebody else and you're vulnerable and you get hurt and it pushes another button. So you go, I mean, I know that's where the courage comes in,
right,
to pursue it and continue.
Right.
So you're saying if you keep doing it, trying not to internalize the hurt.
Also true.
But that takes super, I mean...
Well, and you have to course correct. You have to realize, okay, that wasn't a safe person. So, you know, you course correct. And what you have to do is try to choose your confidants wisely. Like I said earlier, vulnerability requires boundaries. You have to not be vulnerable with everyone, but figure out who you can be vulnerable with. And I'd start with, this is a pretty good group here. I'd start with people here. I mean, they're not perfect. And you're going to get hurt here. You're definitely going to get hurt here. But you've got to be with people who can be vulnerable with you, people who can talk about their hurt and their fears. And, you know, you get angry at each other and you say, you know, that hurt my feelings, and that person has to look at themselves and not try to blame you. Say, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, I misunderstood you and I think I overspoke and I was afraid. You have to deal with you have to be with people who are willing to do that with you. So you have to wisely choose your confidants. Vulnerability is powerful, but you cannot use it indiscriminately. You have to know the context for it.
In short, small groups is good for that.
Small groups, that's right. Like the men's group we were talking about last week, a place like that where we have an agreement to make this a safe place, and we're going to work at making this a safe place. Yeah. All right, I've overstayed my welcome. I have this and other recordings on my website. If you want to, this will be up in about a week or so. You can download it from my website. And also, Charlie and Margaret are here from La Vie. If you have psychological questions, they can answer them right over there. Thank you all for coming.
Service.